I think there's time for two things, really one thing today. First thing is I'll finish off the infrared thing because that's almost done. But then the idea was to do a loop calculation, and the goal of that is to hit things like dimensional regularization, renormalization, and calculate something. You know, QED is full of things that you can actually calculate and then measure to compare to experiment to 10 decimal places, and it works. And so normally what that would lead to is calculating the vacuum polarization and then something else. And I thought that I would just, well, I'm only going to have time for the something else. So I'm going to do the vertex correction. And we'll talk about the divergence and renormalization a little bit. But the thing I'm going to calculate with the vertex correction will just be G minus 2, so the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, and also part of the muon. And because that's something which is, it's UV finite. So it's just basically, you don't have to do anything. It just, if you kind of ask the right question, that you just get a number, and it's a beautiful thing. But first, let's finish the previous thing. Right. And also, as people have been pointing out typos in the, typos and just honest mistakes in the, typos, honest mistakes, and also me not being careful in proofreading things in the assignment. I've been fixing them, and the last time I updated it was yesterday. So take a look, and I don't think there's anything crucial that we haven't already talked about before. But anyway, take a look. And that's on the web page, as is the... Liam, did you say something? Okay, so I thought I heard something. All right. Any questions before we start? All right, so we're finishing off IR divergences. And this is what in the trade is called block Nordseek. So this cancellation I'm describing between the soft loops and the radiation of soft photons is what Bloch and Nordseek did. I can't remember when it was, sometime before the heroes existed, the Earth was still not formed, long time ago. And so the story so far has been, you know, we got some hard process, so we're defining some hard process, a bunch of external lines to it. So that involves, we never allow the photons in here to have a momentum less than some lambda. So, K lambda. So that's not that is not our infrared regulator. This is the stuff that we want this to be small so that all the physics that we're interested in is contained in this. But then we're focusing on the range from little lambda to capital lambda as being the divergent part. And so that's the thing we're tracking. And so we're imagining that somebody's evaluated this. We know what the amplitude for that is. We're calling that M beta alpha. Alpha tens of times going this way or that way. But because in matrix elements, we do it right to left. I'm going to, you know, here's a bunch of states going to some other states. And we imagine that we know what this is. I won't often write that it depends on lambda, but it depends on lambda because that's part of this definition. And then we did a long thing last time where we started dressing this thing with external lines. It was not external lines, but soft photon lines, connecting external lines in this hard process. And the upshot of all that was, if we're focusing in the range, in the momentum range, these soft guys have a momentum in the range from little lambda to capital lambda. And so soft photons and we're interested in asking how, when that thing goes to zero, what diverges. So we're only interested in the singular part. And so in that limit, the leading singular part factorized. And the upshot of the last class was that there was a story where if I call M tilde beta alpha, the thing that I get by dressing with the soft photons, and that was given by what I called curly F times M beta alpha, so that it factorized. So the thing that was singular was this curly F. And then curly F was given by goes little lambda over capital lambda to the a over 2. Times e to the I curly g over 2. And then the expressions for a were explicit, right? So a was minus 2 pi squared, sum over the various external lines that we're connecting things to, a to n and a to m. Remember, a to n is plus 1 if it's outgoing, minus 1 if it's ingoing. Qm and Qn were the electric charges of the lines to which we've attached the photon, divided by 2 pi to the fourth beta mn times a logarithm of 1 plus beta nm, or 1 minus beta nm, where beta nm is the relative speed of particles n and m. So it's the, if you like, it's the speed of particle n in the rest frame of particle m, or vice versa. Same thing. It's a Lorentz invariant expression. You can build it. I gave a formula for it last time explicitly as a function of the two form momenta. It's between 0 and 1 because it's a speed. And g was given by 0 if a to n is not equal to a to m. So that means that if the lines are attaching, like this one, attaching a initial final to initial line, then it's 0. But if we connect two initial or two final lines, then we got something else. And the something else was 4 pi cubed log of lambda over little lambda sum over nm qn qm over 2 pi to the fourth beta nm. That's what we had so far. So it's, so the message is, it's explicitly, you know, a here is negative, right? Because this is bigger than 1. The logarithm is bigger than 1, is positive. And these are, I guess it depends on the signs here. It's certainly possible. This sum, I think it's always negative, but whether it's possible to set this up where it's not negative, I'm not completely sure. But certainly it can be negative, and when it's negative, this is something which is diverging when lambda goes to 0. It looks like it's a power. It is a power. We were talking about logarithms when we were doing this originally, but it's these powers, because it's power to the a, and a is proportional to e squared over 4 pi squared, that's basically alpha. And so this is a power to a perturbatively small coupling, and so you're supposed to think of that as e to the coupling times log of this ratio, and so that you can kind of see that higher powers of alpha are coming with powers of logarithms of this cutoff. So these are the logarithmic divergences at any fixed order in alpha that we would have found. But when we add them up for all the alphas, it's giving us this particular power.
I believe that one of them is n equal nm equal n.
Oh, yes, true. Thank you.
What were etas again?
Eta was it was just plus 1 if it was an outgoing line and minus 1 if it was an ingoing line. What's that?
You were saying you weren't sure how it was always negative. Is it to do with the etas?
No, because I can. If these are both the same, then this would be positive. If they could have the same charge, that would be positive. This thing likes to be positive, but I think you can make it negative because you could connect things to incoming, outgoing, and arrange the charges to be opposite. And the thing I'm not completely sure is if you sum over everything, you're in trouble. But say that again, sorry?
So if the beta nm is negative, then it corresponds to the 0 case.
Here? Yeah. But I'm worried about this. Because the question, I was arguing that this is diverging. Because if this is positive, then the lambda goes to 0, you like it, because it's making it small. You know, so it's, the thing about it diverging was that in any fixed order, it's diverging because it's a logarithm. So it's some of it doesn't matter if it goes to 0 or infinity, but when you sum them all up like this, this could, he's either getting large or small, depending on the sine of A. And what I'm just hedging on is whether or not there can be a process for which A is positive. It's generically negative because it's not hard to make these things positive, but when you sum over them all, that's the thing I'm not completely sure of, if there's a known sign for that. I think there is a statement about the sign of it, but top of my head, I'm going to get it wrong. Anyway, this is the thing that's the singular part as lambda goes to zero. And it's all in a factor is the main thing we've got so far. And it, of course, this capital lambda is an artificial split here at some level, right? So the capital lambda that's here is going to cancel the capital lambda that's here, just because capital lambda is not in the answer at some level. It's just I put it in there to make this definition of hard versus soft, and it's an artificial thing. So we should not, as we see these little lambdas cancel, we should not see the capital lambdas cancels, because something should be keeping the answer, capital lambda, independent. And the thing that I had not done yet was this so far has just been looking at the connections, the internal lines, and now we have to do the thing that's going to cancel with is the case where we have our process here, and now we start looking at emission of various numbers of soft photons. So. And now we know that the dangerous area, that's also going to diverge, and it's going to diverge because of the integral over the phase space of these photons. We have an integral d3p divided by the energy, and so that likes to diverge once we put in all the factors of momentum that are coming from these lines that are getting close to being on shell. And we had this expression for what the amplitude was for that, which I'm just going to write down again, if I can find it. Yeah. So this was an amplitude, but now we're looking at a rate, right? So what we're looking at is the square of something. So the rate for this, let's call it, yeah.
So this expression looks like if A is negative, right? Then we have power law divergence, right? But is there any A for which we have logarithmic divergence?
Well, the idea is that for everything is being done as a series in alpha, right? The e squared over 4 pi. So any particular graph you look at will be a specific term at fixed order in alpha. And the way to think about this is that what I've done is I've summed over all orders of alpha, because I've included all possible numbers of lines, so that I've mixed together things that are different orders in that expansion. You take a fixed order in that expansion, what you're supposed to, the alpha is hidden in A here, because that's basically e squared over 4 pi. So if you wanted to reproduce the expansion, what you do is you Taylor expand this in powers of A, and so that takes this thing, if you take x to the A and think of it as being e to the A log x, then each order in A, it will have a log in. And that's where so any one graph is going to diverge logarithmically, and that's how you'd see it here, is that you'd take this thing, expand it to some fixed order in A, and look at the coefficient, and it'll always have a log of this because you're expanding in the power here. Okay. And that's part of the, I should have emphasized this probably more, but the message of infrared divergences was always that if you do something, it's usually telling you that something you thought you understood, because it's a low energy issue, is blowing up, which means your answer is nonsensical. And that means that something, you've made an assumption that was wrong, or what usually it means is that one of your approximations has failed on you that you were relying on. And in this case, you can kind of see that if I think of x to the a as being e to the a log x, 1 plus a log x, and so on, we were doing a series in A, and you can kind of see that what's going wrong is that because it's diverging, x is going to zero or infinity, and so although that's small, the thing you're expanding in is not small. And so the theory is telling you that you thought you were expanding in A, but you actually weren't really, because the stuff at very, very low energies is accumulating. These things are becoming so large that the suppression by A is no longer suppressing these higher loops that you thought were suppressed. And so you have to think about that part of physics more carefully, is what it's telling you to do. And so the summing over all orders in alpha is necessary, because the thing we're looking at is a place where the series in alpha was failing. And so it sounds like overkill, but it's required because of this fact that because of the divergence. The divergence is something which can compensate for a small coupling constant. And it's telling you something because it's saying that something you had assumed in your calculation, it doesn't really make sense in the way you're using it. All right, so now now we're looking for we want the rate. I'm going to call this gamma beta alpha, but really it doesn't depend just on the labels beta alpha. It depends on all these external momenta. And we're going to imagine that we're going to soft here means we're going to imagine that we're going to sum over unobserved photons. These are very, very low energy photons. We're going to imagine we'll have some minimum energy resolution. So we'll say sum over all photons with k bigger than or equal to e, where e is some physical thing in your problem, like the resolution of your detector. So it's different than capital lambda, and it's different than little lambda. And what will happen is as the little lambdas cancel between there and here, what used to be a log of little lambda over capital lambda will turn into a log of e over capital lambda. So it'd be a ratio of physical things. I mean, capital lambda isn't physical, once we add it to the rest of this thing, it'll turn into a physical scale in your problem, and you're going to end up with logarithms of e divided by some physical scale in the process you're looking at, like the electron mass or something. All right, so what we want to do here is we want to take the amplitude for this, which involved the attachment of photons to the various external lines. And so it's going to be given by, we're going to sum over all the number of photons that are emitted from 0 to infinity. So, and they're all indistinguishable from one another, so there's going to be an n factorial we have to divide by because it doesn't, labeling this one with momentum k and this one with momentum q is not distinguishable from this one having q and this one having k. So we're overcounting if we give them all distinguishable momenta. So there's 1 over n factorial. Then we sum over all their polarizations because we're not measuring them. We integrate over all their final state momenta. And we know that comes with a factor of 2 pi cubed times twice the energy. And then we have the thing I calculated last time, when I'll say what these symbols mean in a second now. So we have mu 1, mu n, contracted with the polarization vectors. Let me put this on the next line. I'm going to run out of space. Times. Times epsilon of mu 1, k 1, lambda 1. And then we'll have a step function which says that our energy never gets bigger than E. So we have to sum over E minus the sum I equals 1 to N omega I. And omega here just means is omega I is short for the absolute value of KI, right? And then this is an M tilde. And so I'll tell you what those things are in a second. So the thing I called M before was the thing that we figured out. So M mu 1 to mu n, that was the thing that was the basic hard process, M beta alpha. And then we had a factor, I'm going to again not give myself enough space here. So we had a factor of P mu. Where did I write that down? So it's eta qp over p dot k. Right. Kn, or k. To sum over, so I've got to be careful. There's a product over all mn. I want to make sure I write this properly. Yeah. So let's write the sum. M1 to Mn and N1 Nn of so I'm running to what I'm going to let me I want to give you the whole thing including the square. So let's just start again. So M tilde mu 1 to mu n epsilon mu 1 epsilon mu n square, and that's going to be equal to M tilde beta alpha squared times sum over M1 to Mn, N1 to Nn, big square bracket of eta N1, Qn1, Pn1, U1, divided by Pn1 dot K1 minus I at N1 epsilon times epsilon mu 1 k1 lambda 1. And then the same thing for all the different 1 now goes to n. So we'll have a bunch of factors, and then we'll have eta nn u. Sorry, I forgot a factor. M1, Qm1, Pm1, Mu1, sorry, Mu1, Mu1. And then I have the same for these factors repeated with, you know, 1 replaced by 2, replaced by 3, replaced by n. And the same thing here for the m. So where do these come from? So originally when we did this for these m's, I didn't have a tilde here. But remember, tilde here is what we got when we dressed all the lines with soft photons. So previously we had a story where we were adding external photons and we had not dressed the hard process with the soft photons, but we are dressing we should be adding this emission to this, and so that's why there's a tilde here, and that's what the tilde is meant to represent compared to the M I showed you last time where this was just not an M tilde. The difference is that this now includes all the sums of the soft photons, so I should be using in this factor, so the F will be there. And then the sum here is happening, so these two terms are coming because, you know, we had an amplitude and we squared it. So that means we're going to get the factor in the amplitude, like this one, for example, for each external line twice, once from the thing and once from its complex conjugate. And I guess I should have had a complex conjugate here. These things don't really matter because in the phase space integrals, we never go near the poles. So you don't have to keep track of that really. And then we have an epsilon and epsilon star for the same reason. And we have that for each polarization vector. So that's the thing we have. That's the dependence on the small k. And the divergence we're looking for is that d3k over omega goes like 1 over k. It's like d3k over k. So if we had two more powers of k, we'd have trouble. And here are the two more powers of k. So that's where the divergence is going to come from. Yeah.
So we assume that the photons are attaching to distinct electron lines.
Yeah. Yeah. I've allowed myself to think that they have different charge than electrons, but that's it. Right. All right. I don't want to put this away. I want to keep this. So if we combine these things, we can kind of write out what the business end is that we're looking at here. So that means that gamma beta alpha, it depends on E, is going to be given by combine that with this, and I'm going to get, I'll get gamma beta alpha tilde. It's the thing which includes the m tilde. This is what I would have gotten if I just asked the problem without the photons, times the sum. So getting from here to here, what I've done is I've done the sum over the lambdas, right? And we know that the sum over the lambdas, I have a lambda and a lambda star. That's something which is eta mu nu plus things involving p mu p nu. So this uses sum over lambda for any one of these photons of epsilon mu of lambda epsilon k lambda, let's say. Epsilon star nu of k lambda. That's the thing that's appearing in the numerator of the propagator, right? So it's eta mu nu plus alpha mu k nu plus alpha nu k mu for some alpha. It doesn't matter what the alpha is. And so this, what's going on is that these terms didn't matter for the same reason as before, because the k is always contracting against this thing. And we have this general story that when we sum over all the ways in which you contract a photon, k mu always gives you zero when it's contracted onto these electromagnetic currents that the photon coupled to. So that goes away. So we just really have these guys. And so we're left with a whole bunch of contractions between a mu, I should have called this something else, new one. So we have a contraction between these momenta, and that's kind of where that came from. And then the rest of it is just a relabeling of things. So rather than counting them over, counting the lines first, what I'm doing is counting the pairs of photons first that were appearing in this. There's always an even number because we've squared this thing. And so then that allowed me to separate the sum over these subscript to m and n and write it in terms of one, where I'm summing over the photon here now, or taking the product of the photon. And what's nice about that is, again, it's exponentially, it's exponentiating. So this and this and this is something which is going to come as a factor, which is an exponent. And the exponent is going to have this the logarithm in it, because it's got the integral as well. So now there's a trick, and I'm just going to show you the trick. I would normally just write the answer down, but I want to show you the trick because I can't remember whether you need it or not in the homework assignment. So just in case, I want to tell you what the trick is, because it's one of those tricks that you may not, you know, it's one of those things where you observe something is true, and then after that it's a lot easier. So what you observe is true is, apropos of nothing, you notice that the integral from minus infinity to infinity of sine of beta sigma over pi sigma d sigma, that's equal to the sine sign of beta. So it's plus or minus one depending on what beta is. And then
I can't see that because there's a microphone.
How's that?
No.
Oh, it really is perfect. It's just okay, that's good to know about that mic. Yeah. No. It's good to see it. So the other thing is so this is just an intermediate step to show you what I'm really going to use is this, as I want to rewrite the step function here for the energy. So the step function is, I'm going to use, so this can be used to show that this is true, and this is what I'm really going to use. Minus infinity to infinity of sine of x sigma divided by pi sigma e to the I a sigma e sigma is a step function. It's a representation of the step function. And all you do is you write this out as sine and cos, and then keep the piece which survives in the integral from minus infinity to infinity, which has to be even under sigma goes to minus sigma. And then what's left is products of sines, which you can write as these things. And then you can kind of see that you're adding up things that involve the sine, S-I-G-N, of this in such a way that you get step function. So with that, you can do some of these integrals. So now let me cut to the chase. No, we're not doing too bad for time, actually. So there's a bunch of steps now, but they're kind of straightforward steps. And so what this becomes, if I start rewriting this sum, the integration and the sum, and I put it in the exponent, it's going to be, there's a step I want to not leave out here. Yeah. So let me do the exponentiation step. So it's so gamma beta alpha is going to be gamma tilde beta alpha times the integral minus infinity to infinity. Being a physicist, to change all the orders of integration. Times the exponential of sum over nm eta n eta m qn qm pn dot pm divided by 2 pi cubed integral d3k over twice the energy k e to the I sigma times the energy of k over pn dot k pm dot k. And the point of that is this integral is starting to look like the thing that we had in curly F over there. And so the point of the exercise is you're going to start recognizing capital A is going to start appearing here too. And it's because this integral is similar to the one that we had already when we were doing the sum over the soft photons. And it's not an accident, because what's happening is, we had propagators rather than sums over physical polarizations, but the propagator is a numerator, which is the sum over the polarizations, which is what we're getting again once we square the amplitude. And then the denominator was a k squared for the propagator, but we're getting two factors of 1 over k from the amplitude when we're emitting the particles again. And so the integral over k you're doing is basically the same integral, because that's why they're diverging in the same way. And the structure of the numerator is coming to you the same way, because the sum over the polarizations is the numerator of the propagator that you had in the when you did the loop graph. So now I can cut to the chase, and the cut to the chase part of it will be that. So the bottom line is that this is gamma tilde beta alpha times e over lambda to the A. So I told you that you get the same A again, times the factor B, which depends on A, and E over lambda. And so I'll write here what the factor is. So A, we know what it is. This is just the power. And so here, this is the kind of thing we're looking for, because now the lambda dependence is actually very much like the lambda dependence we had that's buried in here. So I should write that. So gamma tilde beta alpha is the thing that was, this is the rate built out of, it's the rate that was built out of that m tilde beta alpha over there. So that would be gamma, let me call this the soft emission, just to distinguish it from a gamma without any labels. Well, I should do that over here too. Just because this thing is for a different process. It's emitting photons compared to this guy, which is not emitting the photons. And I want to call the thing without a tilde the thing that was the thing we had when we just had the hard process. So it depends on lambda and E. But it's built from M tilde, so it'll involve a factor of the absolute value of F squared times the thing that we had in the rate. So the M squared is in here, but I still have a curly F squared, which is the difference between gamma and gamma tilde. Because this is built using M, this is built using M tilde, and we're supposed to use M tilde. So that tells you all the factors here. And then the thing that's missing is B, and B is the integral from minus infinity to infinity, d sigma cosine of sigma E over pi sigma times the exponential of capital A times the integral from little lambda capital E dx over x of e to the I x sigma minus 1. And this integral converges, right? Because it should converge. It looks like it's going to diverge here, but this for small x is going to 0. So if you look at the small x limit, I could make this 0. So I can take that to 0, and there's no problem. The divergence has been explicitly isolated here, and this is something which is finite as little lambda goes to 0. So okay.
What's the upper bound? Is that an E?
Oh, the upper limit is capital E, yeah. Yes. Sorry, I can't move that board. So I should probably stay away from that board because of that. But anyway, now you can kind of see the punchline, right? The punchline is that this factor and this factor are going to combine. So gamma soft emission theta alpha equal to gamma theta alpha. And I can go, okay, let's combine them. So we're going to get an E over I'll do it in my head here. So we're going to square this. So we're going to get rid of the 2, and we got lambda over capital lambda to the A. And here we had E over over lambda to the A. So we're going to get E over capital lambda to the A times B. And the E to the G goes away because that's a phase, and it gets killed in the square, and times B of and that's finite as lambda goes to 0, which was the claim. And the thing that's so one way to think about this is, all right, so I know it's going to be finite, so good. But it's also true that the way it became finite is useful, because although everything here is finite as little lambda goes to 0, it's still true that it involves logarithms. You know, if I think of expanding this in powers of alpha, which is A, there's going to be terms at any order in alpha. I'm going to alpha times log of this ratio. And so if this ratio is actually a physically big ratio, so supposing that I can resolve photons down to, a kilovolt, a kiloelectron volt, but I'm interested in a physics process where the energies are a GeV or a 10 TeV, this ratio could be actually quite large. And the logarithm can sometimes be the biggest piece in the problem. And so knowing where the logarithms are is actually half the battle often. And one of the messages of this is, although there was a cancellation of the divergence, there's a residual logarithm in the answer, which is telling you that physics that you're missing, the divergence was telling you you're missing, is actually an important physics, because in the answer that you get that's finite, there's a big numerical piece coming from the fact that there's a large logarithm in your problem. And an example of this was back in the day when they first were doing, when the large electron positron collider was colliding things, they were running electrons and positrons, colliding them at the energy of the Z boson. And so if you plotted the cross-section against energy, it did this, you know, you have a big electromagnetic thing, and then it goes down, then there's a big peak at the Z, which is like 90 GeV. But if you compare the rate that you got to what you calculated in perturbation theory, you actually did a bad job up here. So it turns out that the rate that you got here is higher than, if you kind of took the lowest order calculation, which actually normally works, normally you're thinking the corrections to these calculations are order alpha over 4 pi or something like that, and that's like a 10 to the minus 3 correction often. So you're normally the leading approximation to this cross-section is pretty good. But what happens is that the actual measured cross-section is quite a lot different on the high side of the z-pole. And the reason it is that this process where you emit soft photons is actually important because there's a large logarithm of the energy you're running at divided by the electron mass or the resolution. And that large logarithm times alpha, you know, whereas this is small, alpha over 4 pi times the log of the two scales that were relevant there is much, much bigger than this. So this might have been 10%, whereas this would be 10 to the minus 3. And that logarithm is the thing that if you didn't know about that logarithm, then you really would be worried about the fact that the cross-section disagreed. And the fact that these logarithms are, you know, we didn't need to know the whole answer to all orders in alpha to get the logarithm. You can kind of resum a class of things is important. So this ability to identify the soft part of a graph is in practice often useful even once the divergence is canceled is the main message there. I think that was all I was going to say about that. The thing that I have in my notes is, you know, the divergence that we hit here, this divergence, that says that the differential rate is basically A over E dE, if I get that right.
No, that's not sure.
Yeah.
So you could also make that log small by making the resolution higher. No?
Yeah.
The resolution which you measure, you detect photons.
Right. If that's the only logarithm. If you don't detect them at all, then you lose a lot of information. So the thing is you do detect them often.
You do what?
You do detect them often. And so it's you often want to know, because in this process you're looking at E plus E minus goes to say hadrons or something. So you're looking at a specific kind of a final state, and so you do have information about the final state. So there is a resolution to your ability to distinguish photons, and so it's something which, you know, the experimentalists will tell you what it is, and so it's not like it's you get to dial it. But it's also true that sometimes the logarithm that appears here is the energy divided by, like, the Z mass divided by the electron mass, because you have more than one physical scale in your process. Those logarithms can also be large, and those ones you can't fix. Those are just really there.
No, but then I wonder, like, how would increasing the resolution of the photon help in fixing this graph problem? Like, would it all? Maybe it wouldn't.
Oh, what's that? No, it's just that I can't remember. I deliberately didn't tell you what the energies were here. I can't remember if it's mz over me or if it really. I think it doesn't depend on the photon resolution so much here, because it's not that's not the biggest logarithm. So what's happening in that case is that there's a large logarithm which you can identify. The physics of it is that the cross section is bigger than you thought because this process of radiating photons is actually efficient. And what's happening is that what you really did is you had a collision here where the energies of the process was not exactly at the Z mass. It was higher than the Z mass, but then you lost some energies by radiating photons, and then it looked like it was at the Z mass. And so things up here can fake something without a photon because you're just missing some of the energy that you didn't see because it was a soft photon. And so that's why it happens on this side, not on this side, for example. Because the thing is that there's a whole, the size of this is like 1 over alpha because the decay rate is order alpha. And so the thing is that the amplification of the pole of the resonance compared to the background is something which can fight powers of alpha. So if you get a piece of that like you are here, if you have a resonant collision happening where you're misidentifying the energy, then what will happen is that you'll have a lot of probability out here that you're not bargaining for. And the relevance of this process of soft photons is that that's the way you missed the energy. So you had a reaction where you thought you're looking at E plus E minus goes to quarks or something. And what you But what was also happening was this, you know, where you're emitting a photon from the initial electron. And so if this collision, if you ended up on resonance, the energy that you started off with was really higher than resonance because you lost some of it. And so the competition of this with this is not suppressed by this. It's actually suppressed by this because of the fact that it depends on how much you're missing. And so
if you increase the resolution, you would actually see the photons that you didn't.
You can, to a point, you can, yeah. But
what I mean to say is,
they actually also do that. They do measure the process with photons as well. And so that now it depends on exactly what you measure. Is that for instance, what happens is that sometimes these are neutrinos, and so this would have been e plus and minus goes to nothing, but you can see it if you see the photon, if you see this thing recoil against the photon. So if you look for e plus and minus goes to a photon, and it looks like, you know, it went out half your detector, and so something had to go out the other half you didn't see, you can use that to figure out what the rate is in the neutrinos, for example. So they do measure the emission of photons as well. So sometimes you're interested in that process itself. Sometimes when they started off, they were mostly interested in what the total cross section at the peak here, or the total cross section at various places along various energies, was interesting on its own right. And then these processes of emitting photons was something which is confounding their ability to measure what they wanted to measure. You look confused, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, the message I'm trying to leave here is that you might have thought before you started off this whole process that if people had calculated the cross section just using the tree level process and ignoring the photons, that you would have been wrong a little bit, but your error should have been something at the 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3 level, and it wasn't. It was really remember they used to show the experimental plot against the tree level thing, and it was big. But it was big, as big as it was supposed to be, given that there are large logarithms in this process that at the high energy end, if you do radiate a photon and don't see it, then it's true that this process can be confused with this process. And so it's a correction to the tree level thing that you didn't calculate this when you calculated the tree level thing. And when you include it, you get a bigger change than you bargained for because there's a big logarithm in it. And part of what's confusing is that there's two kinds of logarithms that I kind of was telling about at the same time. And this one is one that's to do with the resolution of the photon.
So if we were studying that tree level process, then we think, okay, we would go out, we would try to measure that process, whatever, the particle accelerator.
Yeah.
Then we're filtering out, when you measure cross-sections, I would imagine you're discarding situations in which you're measuring photons. If you're measuring photons, they're not being included in this calculation, in this prediction of the cross section.
Right. Right. In practice, that's what they're doing. Right.
In practice, that's what they're doing. But then you notice that after your resolution gets low enough, you cannot distinguish whether you emitted the photon or not. And so this curve.
That's not what happens. The thing is, the experimentalists, they go and they look at how well they can see photons, and look at how well they can see, you know, pions or all the different kinds of particles. They have an efficiency for that. And so then they take in some event, and then they see. Let's say they're looking for the cleanest one would be. Let's say they look for muons, because muons just escape the whole. They rifle right out of the detector, and so they would look for a process where they had a whole bunch of the detectors firing in such a way that they knew that, and there's a detector out here that sees that it was a muon. So a bunch of energy goes there, and they know it included a muon because they see it come out outside the detector. That's what they actually see. They see that there's some reaction where I said two things, maybe there's a little bit of activity somewhere else, but not much, and it looked like it was going out, and they had muons in them. So the model is that was a E plus E minus goes to mu plus mu minus, and the cross section is the one I would have gotten at tree level, and that actually does a really great job for this part of it. So if you're kind of looking at what the cross section is on resonance, you do well. But if you do it here, the rate you would predict for these kind of events is not so good. And that's because they don't know for sure that there wasn't a photon that was in here too that got stopped. Because the photons, what happens often is that the photons, they interact electromagnetically. They don't go, they dump their energy. That's how you see they're there. But the muons would go through. And so they know that there's energy in here. They know it was a muon. They can measure the energy, but it could have been a muon and a photon. They can't tell. But they know how much, how energetic the photon would have to be missed that way. If it really was hard enough, then you'd see the photon here, and then it would stop, and then you'd say, well, that was different than that. I know that that's a different process. I would not include it in this thing. But there's an error that they, if it's soft enough, they can't really tell for sure, and then that's the thing that they would be forced to use as E here. But it's something which is just the detector tells you what it is. It's, okay. Another example of that is, as confusing examples, because the example that has the mass ratios is if you look at, the standard model predicts the Fermi constant in terms of alpha and the, or it, the variables you have are the fine structure constant, the Fermi constant, and the Z mass, and the W mass. Those are not all independent. So you get to predict one from the others. And if you had calculated what the Z mass was, say, using the measurement of the Fermi constant from the decay of a muon and alpha from electromagnetism, the error you get there at the lowest order, you don't do badly, but the error is not 10 to the minus 3. It's bigger than you would have thought the error should have been, and it's important to know what your theoretical errors are. And that's another example where the alpha that you use in these accelerators is alpha at the energies of the accelerator, not alpha where you're measuring it down at in condensed matter physics. So it's not equal to 1 over 137, it's equal to 1 over 128, because it ran, the electromagnetic coupling runs with energy logarithmically, and so what counts there is alpha times the logarithm of the mass of the Z divided by the mass electron, and that is much bigger than alpha is. And so that the error, the disagreement between the tree-level prediction and the measurement of the Z mass, I'm saying the Z mass, but I think it's the W mass I want to be saying. But this disagreement is something which is only a disagreement if you use the wrong value of alpha. And then what that really says is that you had to sum up these powers of alpha log of, the logarithms were again important in making the theory agree with the experiment. I wasn't intending to say that, so I'm kind of a little bit pulling it out of my butt. So the details I don't have on my fingertips. All right. Okay. Good. So if we're happy, so I'm going to move on to like a loop calculation, and that's going to be, I'm going to aim at G minus 2 of the electron and the muon, but really the electron mostly, and that's going to involve, dealing with UV divergences.
Regarding that, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was a new measurement of the muon, the discrepancy of the G minus 2 for the mu, so there was one year and a half ago or so, but there was a new one, I think, recently.
Uh-huh. I think it's an ongoing experiment, yeah. I don't know what when the last thing came out. And there's a long-running, for those who don't know, there's a long-running, disagreement between theory and experiment. But the error is it's always a question, if you measure, G minus 2, and you take, experiment 1, experiment 2, experiment 3, somebody gets a measurement, and they may be consistent or not, but then there's also the theory prediction, and the theory prediction in this case is something like this. And then so then the idea is that these are in tension. So there's a, I can't remember the number of standard deviations, but it's kind of 3 to 4. It's kind of in the interesting range where it looks like there's something going on. But right after the paper where they put the experimental thing out, there's another theoretical evaluation which was different. And so the question is always, the calculation we're going to do is going to be easy, but if you get to the accuracy that these people are measuring, they're now down at the level where so we're going to do this graph. So we're going to imagine that we have an external electromagnetic field and electrons, say a magnetic field, electron, and then we're going to look at its energy, so that's how we'll measure the magnetic moment. And this is a correction to that, which will come in at order alpha, because there's an E here and E here, and the corrections are typically alpha over 4 pi, or E squared over 16 pi squared. because alpha, you remember, is e squared over 4 pi. I can't remember if I told you that. So anyway, the so this is that's fine. We're gonna so with the, we get a prediction for we're gonna calculate the prediction for this, but people have gone the measurement error now is so good that you have to go to higher powers of alpha than this, and they're at a level where they actually care about things like this, where these are quarks. And so this is actually strongly interacting stuff, and it's at low energies, and so it's a hard thing to calculate, and so it becomes that's the leading uncertainty in the theory, on the theory side now. And so then the debate is, you know, are strong interactions are hard, you know, maybe they're this might be their theory part might be wrong. So there's a debate as to whenever there's a tension like that, the first thing you worry about is does it go away if you do it again more carefully.
So we don't understand the theory so well that say confidently, oh, this is like new physics, so we're not at this stage yet.
Well, I think it depends. Now that depends on who you ask. So I think some people think that they are at the stage. The people who tell you these error bars would say, yes, we are at that stage. But then, you know, other people who do the same error bars seem to be saying they don't agree. And so then the question is, you want to really have them agree? And I don't have a take on it myself. It's not as straightforward as we calculate some graphs and it's right or wrong. It's you really have to deal with some strong interaction physics there. So they're doing an inference which is more complicated to do than what we're going to do.
Is that like non-perturbative stuff when you have strong interaction?
Basically, yeah. So what they do is so you can do that on a lattice, or they use the fact that that you know a lot about there's a. Causality says that if you know what's going on here, if you know what you're trying to evaluate this graph, where these are basically photons, and this graph will be complex. And it turns out that if you take the imaginary part of this amplitude, it's related to the rate for what you would have gotten if you cut the graph in half. So if you took the rate for photons if you take this thing and take those external lines, put them here, those external lines, put them here. If you take the rate for, say, E plus, E minus goes to pairs of quarks, the square of that rate so is related to the imaginary part of this thing. So what they do is they measure this, you know, the way that I was talking about over there. You measure the cross-section for producing quarks from initial electrons as a function of energy, and then there's a dispersion relation that allows you to relate that to this, because the real and imaginary parts of these things are related by causality. And they use that, that's a way of estimating this if you can't do the numerical calculation from scratch. And, you know, and so that's what they do. Some people do it that way, using the data. Some people do it with the lattice. And that's part of the, you know, they should be agreeing at some level if it got their errors right. And then the question is, you know, what do they get and how do they agree? And there's a debate going on there. Okay, so we're going to be interested in what's called the vertex correction. That's this thing here, where basically the vertex correction would be any kind of a graph with electron in, electron out, and a photon out, and nothing else, which is one particle irreducible. So it can't be broken into two by breaking the graph, by cutting one line of the graph. And so what we're going to calculate when it comes down to it is we're going to calculate the matrix element of an outgoing electron, the electromagnetic current, and an incoming electron. And the idea would be that would appear, if we had had an interaction Hamiltonian, which was minus J dot A for magnetic field, the matrix element of this would be to do with the energy shift of the electron in the magnetic field, and A would be a classical field in that case, but we'd want the matrix element of this in the electron, and that's what this is going to tell us at some level. So the access to the experimental information, the energy that they're going to measure is going to come by doing perturbation theory for some energy level with this, and so the thing that's going to be important is this matrix element. That's the bottom line. And I'm going to tell you just what the answer is for what the magnetic moment is. So if you do this exercise and you ask what part of this is the magnetic moment, I'll tell you what that is explicitly, but I won't go through that in great detail. But it's not nothing you can't do. So it's I invite you to do that. Right. And now divergences are going to play a role. And so I want to take a detour about divergences a little bit. And part of that detour we took already. So you remember that when we took a general graph, so we know that a graph with L loops contains a factor e squared over 16 pi squared to the L. So there's some powers of the charge which are to do with the number of external lines. The more external lines you have, typically that'll the interaction you're looking at is going to involve more interactions, so there'll be a fixed cost for some process. If you scatter 16,000 electrons, it'll cost you more powers of alpha than if you scatter two of them. But for any one set of fixed external lines, the corrections with more and more loops in them are the ones that are being punished by powers of alpha. And we also know, this is the first thing we know that a graph with E external photon lines and E external electron lines, the divergence of that graph, the superficial degree of divergence was 4 minus 3 halves the number of electrons minus number of photons. So we knew that, and the criterion was D bigger than or equal to 0 is going to be something that diverges in the ultraviolet. And the reason we're doing this is I want to, the first thing you're going to do, if you're going to calculate this, and we want to do this at one loop, so we want the first correction, so we know at tree level, that basically corresponds to a factor of E times gamma mu. Because that's what the Feynman rule would have been for that vertex, essentially. There's some factors of I here, but that's basically the bottom line is that that's what that vertex would have been. And so this blob starts off being the electric charge times the gamma matrix. And we're interested in the correction to that, so we're going to be taking the L equals 1 case. This is the L equals 0 case. So we know that for this particular process, the total number of powers of E will be E times this loop factor. If I put in the external lines, we calculated how the factors of E, including the number of external lines, if we'd applied it to this particular example, there'd be an additional E in addition to these ones, and that's this one. And so so the loop amplitude we're going to get so the blob here, which I'll define kind of more carefully in a second, it starts off with there'll be some normalization that we'll have to get right when I make this precise, but it's going to start off with this thing we had at lowest order, and then there'll be 1 plus e squared over 16 pi squared times something. And then we'll have a series which we can work to as far as we want. And our goal is to calculate C, essentially. That's where we're headed. And the first thing you do is you say, well, is C finite? Is it something which diverges in the ultraviolet? And this is the way we tell. So the thing is that we have a case where we have two electron lines, and we have one photon line. And so in this case, that means that this is 3, and that's a 1. So this is D is going to be 0 in our case. And D equals 0 is included here, and that's the divergence would have been proportional to lambda to the D. So you might have thought, well, D equals 0 is not diverging, but that's the logarithm. So lambda to the D with D equals 0 is what we mean by something which is going to diverge like log lambda in the ultraviolet now. So we're focused not on the infrared anymore, but now we're on the ultraviolet. So we should be expecting this thing to diverge. But what we also know is, we have momentum P coming in here, P prime coming out, and this Q that's coming out will be equal to P minus P prime because of momentum conservation. So those will be the P and the P prime if in our matrix element, let's say. If we want to know the expectation value of the current in a specific state where P prime is equal to P, that'll be the case where Q is going to 0. So this thing, C is not a constant, it depends on P and P prime. So one of the things we're going to want to do is we want to write out what's the most general dependence we could have had that's consistent with all the symmetries of the problem, like Lorentz invariance and the current conservation. So that's what we'll do first, and we'll get you'll see that this the thing that's not known here is basically two functions, invariant functions, Lorentz invariant functions of Q squared. And so that's the first thing we're going to do.
Should it be lambda to the power d over d?
Say that again?
Should it be lambda to the power d over d, like divided by d as well, like the whole thing?
There's some number here which I'm not telling you anyway. So it's if I divide by d, that's just part of the number. Is that what you mean?
I'm just saying that the logarithmic divergence means some lambda to the power something which goes to zero divided by something which goes to zero.
Yeah.
It's not the limit. It's just that when that d is equal to zero, you get log divergence.
Yeah. This is the way I was. Remember the way that d was being calculated is we had some integrals, you know, d4k for each loop, and then we had some integrand which I basically just counted as being powers of k, you know, on dimensional grounds. And then I just said this, and the upper limit was lambda. So I said on dimensional grounds, that'll go like lambda in this case to the 4 plus r or something like that. And so the thing is that if r had been zero, if 4 plus r had been zero, that would have been the case dk over k. That's where you would have got a log. That's what I mean by the log. Yeah. Right. So the good news is that this fact that this is d equals zero in that argument I just erased, and d4k. Some integrand which depends on k, it depends on p and p prime as well. So when we actually do the Feynman graph for what we're gonna write down, we're gonna have some integral like this. We'll have one loop, one integral because there's one loop, and we know that there's an integral for every loop essentially. And then the integrand will depend on all three of these variables. And the estimate I gave you that told you whether it was diverging was based on all the dimensions were being used by k, because I was thinking that's the biggest scale in the problem. When I take I look at k's near the cutoff, they're much bigger than the external momenta, and so then I can dimensionally just think of the k's as being the thing that are dominating, and that's kind of what led to the estimate of lambda to the d for these graphs. But if I'm interested in a specific momentum dependence, so if supposing this answer, c of p and p prime, and possibly lambda, is given by the integral we're going to get to, what this is showing you is that the in order to get a divergence at all, because d is zero, it's just barely diverging. And so in order to get a divergence at all of the dimensions had to come from k. If I look at a piece of c which is linear in p for some reason, it's going to turn out that the magnetic moment that we're interested in is actually a piece of this vertex function which is linear in p. That'll be finite in the ultraviolet, because once I've used up a power of the dimension with an explicit factor of p, then what will happen is that this remaining thing will not converge, because it was just logarithmically diverging before. But if I use part of the dimensions with a p, I've got one less power of k, and that means that what was a logarithmic divergence is now converging as lambda goes to infinity. So what that says is that this thing is going to be some constant independent of p, which is diverging, a divergent constant, plus p dependent but finite. So when we do this calculation, there will be a divergence, but we only have to really worry about it if we're interested in the piece of this vertex which is independent of momentum. That's the main message that this power counting is telling us. But the thing that is independent of momentum will diverge, but happily, that's also includes the thing that we had at lowest order. And so that's the renormalization story in this language is going to come about, because the divergence, the only thing that's going to diverge here will be something where this does not depend on momentum. And then that's something which you would confuse with this. And so the issue there is that anything in here, if C at P equals P prime equals zero, if that's not zero, that means basically the strength of the electromagnetic interaction is given by this blob. You have a field, you have an electron going through it, and you ask, what does its energy change by? If there's a contribution here which is not vanishing when the momentum is zero, that would count as part of your measurement of the electric charge. And so if this is not zero, that means that what you're calling E in your Lagrangian was not really the charge. It was just some parameter which at lowest order in E agreed with the charge. But if you do things more accurately, this parameter and the physical charge aren't the same thing. And so you have to, what you like to do, so I should finish the sentence here. So if this, then E in the Lagrangian is not the physical charge. Same thing's true for all the parameters in the Lagrangian. The thing we call M in the Lagrangian, when we say the Lagrangian has a piece our Lagrangian was minus 1/4 f mu nu minus psi bar d slash plus m psi, and then there was a minus iq plus ie minus ie a mu psi bar gamma mu psi. But this is the thing that's contributing our tree level piece here in that graph. But we also, you know, we've been talking like this as if it was the charge. We've been talking about this as if it was the mass. But all of those things we have to step back and re-ask again, because if we calculate the mass, a physical measure of the mass of the electron, say what's the smallest energy of a single particle state, and we do it to some order in alpha, which is not leading order, what we're going to find is that the thing that's appearing in the Lagrangian is not the mass. It's the first approximation to the mass, but the physical mass. So M physical will be M, you know, 1 plus some number times alpha over 4 pi plus da da da. And E physical is going to be E 1 plus another number alpha over 4 pi plus da 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 da. And so what we should be doing, what we want to do to make a prediction is we calculate something like electron scattering, say something we want to measure. And we were writing it in terms of M and E, thinking that what we were doing is expressing it in terms of things we know, the electron mass and the electron charge. But that's not quite right. If we're doing this thing if we're doing the calculation at an accuracy where we have to include powers of E, then what we're doing is we're expressing it in terms of this and this, but what we wanted to do was express it in terms of this and this, because these are the things we actually measure. So there's a step where we have to go through and say, take the parameters in a Lagrangian, re-express them in terms of the physical things, and that's the physical prediction, because the predictions are, I take something I observe, and I measure something else that I observe, and I calculate it, and I get it as a function of the other things I've measured. And so if you write this as being m minus delta m plus delta m, and write this as being e plus delta e, or sometimes you write this as being z1 times e, then if I do this, then ZZ1 would be 1 plus, you know, some number alpha over 4 pi. Then what we have to do is there's a problem with perturbation theory, right? Because in perturbation theory, what we do is we imagine that we have an unperturbed Hamiltonian. And we imagine that the particle states that we're perturbing around are real particle states. So these particle states, such as electrons, they had a mass, they had properties like an electric charge. And one of the assumptions you make in perturbation theory, and when you do it, you turn on an interaction adiabatically and you turn it off, you're assuming that the spectrum of the free Hamiltonian is the same as the spectrum of the interacting Hamiltonian. So an electron in real life is labeled by some mass, and we perturb around a Hamiltonian which is describing an electron which has that mass. If we chose to perturb around an electron with a different mass, then we're going to get big changes. If we calculate a process which is below the mass of the unperturbed electron, we might find that something happens which shouldn't happen at all, and that has to be badly described by perturbation theory. The perturbation theory assumes, so if perturbation theory assumes the spectrum of H naught and H agree. So for scattering, that's usually true. But it's only true if we choose, when we write the unperturbed thing, if we write this as the unperturbed thing, the M that appears here should have been M fizz, not M. So what we should really do is we should write the M that was here, write that as being, or I should have written a minus here, I think. So write this as being M fizz minus delta M, and then we'll put this in the unperturbed Lagrangian, but this has to be in the perturbed Lagrangian, because that's something which is order alpha. It's something which is suppressed by couplings. the difference between the parameter that we start with and the physical one is down by alphas. And so that means that our Feynman rules now include our Feynman rule for the basic vertex, but now we have a new Feynman rule, which is I have a small delta m in front of this, so it's something which looks like an electron where just something happens here. And the Feynman rule for it will be that it'll be a delta m there.
Well, that's the self-energy, right?
That's part of the self-energy, yeah. That's the zero momentum part of the self-energy. Okay. It's also true, since we've gone this far, that that's not the only divergence in the problem, right? We've got two divergences here, but d equals zero happens for more than just that, right? We can make a list of what are all the things for which d is bigger than or equal to zero. So d equals zero, you know, EE is even because there have to be an even number of fermions to have a Lorentz invariant Lagrangian. So the E is either zero or two, right? So if E is zero, it could be four, but once E is four, then D is always is always negative. But if E is zero, then E gamma can be anywhere between zero and four and diverge, right? So D is greater equal zero. If I take EE equals zero, then E gamma equals 1, 2, 3, and 4, or zero, I guess, 1, 2, and 3, 4. And if EE is equal to 2, then E gamma can be 0 or 1, and that's it. If EE is 4, then already D is negative, and then doesn't matter what E gamma is. So what are those graphs? There's a graph where nothing comes out. There's a graph where one photon comes out. There's a graph where two photons are attached. There's a graph where there's three photons. A graph where there's four photons. There's a graph where there's two electrons and no photons. There's a graph where there's two electrons and one photon. And this has d equals 4, d equals 3, d equals 2, d equals 1, d equals 0, d equals 1, and d equals 0. And we've been talking about this one so far, but this is the rest of them.
Those are the Stephen Diddley sins.
Yes. And the next thing is that some of those sins are not gauge invariant, so you don't have to worry about those. So it looks like you'd need to know seven things in order to take care of all these divergences in your Lagrangian. And I've been arguing, say, that the divergence that's appearing here is going to be the thing that we're going to bury in the electric charge of the electron, because the physical electric charge of the electron wasn't what we had in the Lagrangian. And this is diverging with d equals 1. That means that I could get something which is proportional to lambda here, but I could also get something proportional to the electron mass times the log of lambda. So there's actually two different divergences in there. And that's like saying that, or another way of saying that is if I looked at so there's something which could be independent of momentum but proportional to lambda, or I could have had something involving a p, or I could have had something involving an m with a log of lambda. So there's actually two things that could be happening here, depending if I pull out a physical momentum or a mass. And so the case where I had no momenta was what we were talking about here for the mass. But this would be something which would correspond to something which is not the mass, and it could also diverge. So that's something which we have to talk about what that means. This is something which is just barely diverging, but there's no gauge invariant thing I can make with, remember, this has to satisfy that p mu times whatever this thing is, call it pi mu nu lambda rho, that has to vanish. So whatever this thing is, it had to be built from Lorentz tensors and the momenta going in, and there's nothing I can write down which is independent of momentum which satisfies that. And so the gauge invariance, although you can get an amplitude like this, it'll turn out that gauge invariance will forbid you getting something which is diverging. So we don't have to worry about these things with four photons. Same thing's true here. This one will diverge, and it looks like it could have been something diverging quadratically independent of momentum, or it could have been something involving one momentum and a lambda, or it could have been something involving two momenta and a lambda, log of lambda. This won't happen because of gauge invariance. Again, it's got to be p mu on pi mu nu has to be zero, And if I build it out of things that are not momenta, it has to be eta mu nu, and that so some number times eta mu nu doesn't satisfy that p mu on it is zero unless that number is zero. So gauge invariance will forbid that. Lorentz invariance will forbid this because you can't make something with has only you need something else to make the other index, and so you can't have only one momentum. You have to have at least two. So this is the dangerous one. And the thing is that so you might have thought that. And so what happens is that there will be a divergence here, so that actually will be present. So these will be present, and this is present. This one and this one can't be distinguished because they both involve no momentum. So what I should really write here is, I should write the answer here is going to be something independent of momentum plus something involving a momentum plus other things potentially. And this could have a log in it, and this could have both a lambda and a log lambda. They could both be there. Doesn't really matter. There's nothing I can write down here which is gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant, so this doesn't happen. And this does happen, but it's the vacuum energy basically, so it's something which it's there, but because there's no external lines, you don't see it in quantum electrodynamics. You have to have something interact with it in order to see it, and so if you had a graviton, then you could see that, and then that's the cosmological constant problem. Essentially, that is there, and you have to worry about it. And if it's there, it's going to diverge like lambda to the fourth. But you would renormalize that into some parameter in your problem, which in this case would be the vacuum energy of the vacuum. So if you ask what were the parameters that we had to absorb divergences into, it looks like we're still short, right? Because we had two, that one and that one, and we had four divergences, five if you count this one. Then we also could have had the Lagrangian. We could have always added a constant here, right? So that would renormalize this divergence. That would renormalize that divergence. That would renormalize that divergence because it's independent of momentum. But the other two look like they're trouble. The one that involves p here, and this one, and. So the thing that's missing is the reason that you still have freedom to absorb those divergences is that this was not really the most general. This was the most general Lagrangian we could have written, but we actually made some choices when we wrote this. We could have written this down with some function, some number z1 here, and another number z2 here. That would have been the most general thing that we could write down, which is Lorentz invariant. But we didn't do that because we said, well, if we had done this, I could always just redefine psi goes to z2 to the minus 1 half psi, and then that number is 1. And I could have taken a mu goes to z1 to the minus 1 half a mu, and then that number is 1. So we'd made that choice in writing this Lagrangian down. So we might have to remake that choice again. So what will happen with these other divergences, this is something involving two momenta in the two photons and two momenta. And this is something, this coefficient is something which involves one momentum and two fermions. And those are our missing ones, right? The guy here, which has a momentum and two electrons, is the thing that would correspond to a divergent, can be removed by a divergent rescaling of psi. And this one here, which involves two momenta and two photons, is the thing that we can remove by doing a divergent rescaling of the electromagnetic potential. So those are called the wave function renormalizations. We normalized the fields to make the Lagrangian standard, and then quantum corrections ruined it, so we had to renormalize the fields. That's where the word comes from. That's why it's called renormalization. Okay, so it's clear. So what we should do is continuing this thought. In addition to this, what we should do is we should say A mu is equal to Z1 A mu. This is not what I think they call this Z3 normally. And psi, we should write that as being Z2 times psi. That's what's called Z2. And I think this is what's called Z1. There's factors, other factors. This is what you would define to be Z1 is, I think this would be Z1, Z2 to the minus 1, Z3 or something like that, to the minus 1 half. You define this so that once you've done these rescalings, they cancel, and then all you're left with is the Z1. So it might be plus and plus here. I can't remember which one, but
one of the A's are bare A.
These would be the bare ones, and these would be the renormalized ones.
Yeah, we use the same notation because of that.
It'll be clear in context, but if you like that, the thing we started with, we'll call that the bare thing. And so now we're saying that there's a convention choice here, which I'm not being careful about. Probably people would write a one and a half here, but I'm not gonna worry about that. Actually, if I'm gonna do that there, I should do it here. So 1/2 A renormalized, psi bare 1/2 Z renormalized. So the convention there, if I put a half here, the convention is that I would have called the coefficient here Z. And so what we should do is think of, you know, Z1 is equal to 1 plus some number times C1 alpha over 4 pi, there's some series. Same thing's true for Z2. It'll be 1 plus another number alpha over 4 pi. And this number might be divergent. That's something that's part of the story, is that these numbers will be divergent. But the fact that they're divergent is actually irrelevant, because it's physically, if we want to make predictions, we want to express things in terms of the measured properties. And so even if these things had all been finite, you'd still want to do this, because the goal is to just make predictions as functions of things that you're measuring, the physical mass and the physical charge. So all of these things are going to give us new Feynman rules. So that, you know, if we have the Feynman rule for this, and then we had the Feynman rule for the mass, which I call x, but we also have a Feynman rule where I write z minus 1 here. So this will give me something like delta m plus, you know, 1 minus z times p slash, say. There'll be some Feynman rule like that if I am careful about what these z's are, which is encoded, that's coming from this and this. And that I have put in the perturbed part of the Lagrangian, because I want to have my bare, unperturbed Lagrangian and Hamiltonian to be the physical ones that I normally choose, where these coefficients are 1 and the masses are the physical ones, and so on. And there'll be also a piece coming from this. So there'll be some counterterm. These are called counterterms, which will have the form of, it's got to be gauge invariant, so it'll be something p squared times a to mu nu minus p mu p nu times some constant, which will be something like z2 minus 1. There's some factor here I'm not getting right. You have to keep these powers carefully, and I'm not doing that here. But you can kind of see that there will be a Feynman rule for each of these new graphs. You know, we had this and this, we had this for the bare charge, and we'll also have this for the counter charge, and we'll put those together and make that into the physical charge. And so when we draw these graphs, the message is that we will have also counterterm graphs we have to keep track of. And these counterterm graphs, there's the divergent part of the graph is going to cancel the divergent part of the counterterm, and that works because of this counting of these d's. We know that the only things that are going to diverge are things for which we have a counterterm. That's what it means to be renormalizable. And the second part of the story, I've lost my thought. And it was good too, whatever it was. That was it's lost me now. It'll come back at some point. So I'll stop. This is a good place to stop. But the plan now is I want to do this. And we're going to have to decide. Oh, that's the thought. So the divergent part of these graphs is going to be canceled by these counterterms, but that always leaves an ambiguity as to what's the finite part of the counterterm. Because when you have two quantities, one of which is diverging, both of which are diverging, and you subtract them, there's always an ambiguity in defining what you meant by the divergent part, because I can always add a finite piece to it and it's still divergent. So the thing is that there's always an ambiguity in the finite part of a divergent graph. And so part of the story will be we will have to choose these counterterms to enforce a physical thing. And the physical thing we'll enforce is we want the mass to be the physical mass, or we want the charge to be the physical charge. And so there will be what's called a renormalization condition, which is what defines the finite part of the counterterm. And that's in addition. So the cancellation of the divergence will happen for free. And then you're left with what defined the finite part. We'll have to be precise as to how we define the physical mass, how we define the physical charge. And that definition will then tell us how to deal with the finite parts of all these graphs we're going to hit. So the goal is, in the last lecture this afternoon, is to do that for the vertex correction at one loop. And And what will happen is there will be a divergent part, which will be momentum independent, which we can parameterize. So the plan is we regularize things. So we just have a way of talking about the integrals where they make sense. So we introduce new parameters, which if you turn the parameters off, it diverges again. But when the parameters are not turned off, it's finite. And we want that choice to be, it preserve as many things as we like as possible, like the symmetries of the problem, Lorentz invariance, gauge invariance, all those things. Doesn't really matter how we do it, one thing I'll tell you about. Once we've done that, then we can kind of be very specific about what the finite parts and divergent parts are. And then what you'll see is that we'll find that the divergence, in this case, will just be the momentum independent piece. We can isolate it. And then the momentum dependent part, which we'll ask what is the piece which contributes to the magnetic moment, it will be linear in the momentum. And so we will not be diverging. And so how we deal with the divergence won't matter for the G minus two part of the story at one loop. And then we'll get the answer and it'll be the answer that everybody else gets and you all go home happy. So see you guys at 2:30.